That's a personal question. The emergence of peekaboo, the emergence of tower building, the emergence of whacking objects together. So I like to call that whacking and stacking.
Any part of the work that sticks out in your mind as being the most difficult, or something that you had to fail at a ton before figuring it out?
It feels like everything feels like that.
This is Brain Inspired.
Welcome. This is Paul Middlebrooks. Today I talk with Dan Yeamans, who runs his neuro AI lab at Stanford, where every computational neuroscientist I seem to talk to resides. Like in the last episode with Ryan Poplin, Dan uses convolutional neural networks. So I'm not going to summarize what those are here. You can either go back and listen to episode 6 with Ryan, or find the show notes at braininspired.co to learn more. Unlike Ryan from last episode, Dan and his team employ convolutional neural networks to model part of our visual system, the ventral visual system, which is a series of brain regions that, through multiple layers, leads to processing abstract properties of what we see, like objects in the world. And he goes about it in an interesting way. They teach the models how to perform a task and then ask what the neuron-like units in the model look like. And it turns out the units in different layers of their model look like the neurons found in different layers of the ventral stream of the visual cortex in the brain. So we talk a little bit about what that means. You'll hear we go pretty fast and cover a lot of ground, so just a warning there. So hang on to your hat and tighten your stirrups. But if it does all feel too fast, try to hang on, because in the later part of the show, we talk about Dan and his team's recent work building an AI agent that learns like an infant via intrinsic motivation to explore its virtual world, pay attention to objects, and collect those objects together. So playing type behaviors. This episode goes a little bit longer than recent ones, so I will leave it at that. There are a plethora of show notes on this one, so don't hesitate to refer to them on the website. I've seen a lot of new faces on Twitter, so that's been fun, and I look forward to conversations with many of you there. Okay, here is Dan Yeamans and his magical convolutional neural networks. All right, Daniel Yeamans, welcome, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm interested to hear how it goes.
Well, so I will have introduced you more at the beginning of the show, but you run your neuro AI lab at Stanford, and your lab runs on this beautiful cycle of learning more about the brain to improve artificial intelligence and machine learning, to learn more about the brain to improve AI and machine learning, and so on. But let's cut to the chase here. What do you plan to name the AI infant child that you build soon?
Oh, you know, that's a personal question. I think we're far enough away that what we have now is not yet, or in any time in the next couple of years, at least, is not not yet quite ready for a name, okay. a human name. Okay. But I do think that's a good question. I mean, it is the goal in the long run, not so much to build a child, but we'd love to be able to understand like the cognitive underpinnings of what 18-month-old kids are doing, because there's something, you know, between 0 and 18 months, a lot of really amazing things are happening. And I think that's a good way to think about what a kind of sort of moonshot project is that I'm really interested in.
Well, I was alluding to some of your most recent work using convolutional neural networks to make these self-aware AI agents that seek to learn about their world. And we'll talk about that toward the end of our conversation. I mean, you've been using deep learning techniques and studying the brain for some time now. Do you think of yourself more as a neuroscientist or an AI researcher or something else? And how do you describe what you do?
You know, it's interesting. I think we spend most of our time on developing new AI algorithms. Some of our time analyzing neural data collected by other people who we work with, our colleagues, with those neural networks, and some of our time collecting and then analyzing behavioral data. So I think there's a little bit of AI researcher, there's a little bit of sort of neuro data scientist in there, and there's a little bit of psychology, I would say. So it's really some combination of those things. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, I think psychology is the motivation. It's the source of motivation. It's the source of phenomenology of interest. Mm. I mean, the only reason the brain is interesting is because it does behavior. And so for me, like I feel like I'm, from an inspirational point of view, I'm a psychologist. From a technical point of view, it's an AI researcher. And then somewhere in between, there's a kind of check, a sort of check, are we going in the right direction? And that's where the neuroscience comes in.
Hmm. I like that. Maybe you need to change your lab name to Neuro AI Psych Lab or something.
Right, right. That becomes too long. But,
right. It's what a cool name that you got for that you have for your lab too. Have you copywritten that thing?
No, but my students were very excited to make a snail logo. So they've done that.
Oh, good, good. Okay, well, you've taken a fruitful approach using convolutional neural networks to model parts of our brain, specifically sensory areas. Recently, I had David Cicillo on the show, and he uses recurrent neural networks to model parts of our brain. And he said what you do is downright silly. How do you respond to that?
Silly? No. Really? Oh, no. He's sort of my twin, you know, so he might have said the same thing. We're actually coming at it in a certain sense in a very good sort of common spectrum. Actually, we just had a paper together. I don't know if he told you about that.
Oh, no.
So I'll forward that to you where we use convolutional recurrent neural networks to think about things.
Oh, I saw you give a talk and where you had mentioned that, and I was wondering where that had come from. So
yeah, so that's Dave and I together.
Cool.
You know, his work has mostly had been in a world where sensory inputs were not that important. So it was basically trying to understand dynamics in the motor system. That's where his work had the most connection to neuroscience. And that's a very different domain than vision, which is mostly sensory driven. And so I think it's just different parts of the brain and different types of behavior naturally have different things where you would start with. Like, it's evident that the visual system is a recurrent system, but a lot of its functionality can be explored and understood using feedforward processing to begin with. And, you know, I think that I like to start simple. So you start with the simplest thing that you know about and ask how much does it fail to explain the data that you think is interesting. And so that data is interesting and important because you can use it to support a lot of really interesting patterns. And so the question becomes, what is the simplest thing that you need to explain that structure? And I think that in many ways, the sort of feed forward edge, the sort of first 100 milliseconds of processing, roughly, is pretty feed forward, probably. And that explains quite a bit of what is observed. Definitely not all of it. But it seems like a good place to start. So that's kind of why we start from a feed-forward point of view.
Very good. I guess my one attempt to really start a podcast guest fight really failed there. But
No, I mean, yeah, no, Dave and I really, I think that, like, you know, it's sort of been we've been for years wanting to do something together and have finally done that. So I can point you to that paper where we show that networks that are sort of hybrids of convolution and sort of the feed-forward piece, the convnet that you mentioned, and recurrent structures, when properly dealt with, can actually do a pretty good job of predicting neural response dynamics, so yeah, like the temporal patterns. And so that's obviously the direction you need to go in if you want to think about temporal patterns. But, you know, I've always been, like, simpler first, and so I want to try, like, if you already have something, you want to ask how bad are your simpler methods for explaining something before you ask the more complicated things. And so probably from a sensory perspective, recurrence is more complicated. From the point of view of a motor perspective, like where Dave is starting, I would say that it's like you wouldn't want to bring, you kind of have to start with RNNs. And moreover, like, you want to have mostly be studying the part that is, like, stimulus independent, like the way that the arm generates its internal motions.
Right.
So that's
right.
Like, it's like orthogonal to the question of what the way the system responds to inputs, right? Visual inputs, let's say,
right,
or sensory inputs. And so, like, in that case, it's like the CNN part has become very tiny and the recurrence is important. Whereas in the the beginnings of studying the visual system, it's like the recurrence is much less important, and you want to talk about mostly the responses of the system to its inputs. And so it's just different types of problems make sense as ways to begin studying different systems. Although ultimately everything is everything, right? So everything is a dynamical system. Everything is an RNN. Everything has sensory input. There's a probably an important feed-forward component to many things. So, there are probably reasons to bring things together, ultimately, together in many different places. And so, but I think we're only just beginning to get to the place where that makes a lot of sense from a, say, convolutional recurrent point of view in vision.
Very good. Okay. That touched a lot right there. I want to dive into how your models work, actually. But before we do that, I want to jump the gun a little bit and mention the interesting approach that you take here. You use what you call a goal-driven approach. So you train your models to perform a cognitive task, let's say an object recognition task. So you identify objects in scenes with a lot of noise or distraction. So the model is trained to do that, to optimize on that. And then you examine the units in the model to see how they compare with the activity of single neurons in animals that performed the same task. So you're not modeling the neurons, you're modeling the cognitive process, and voila, you find you can accurately predict the activity of neurons. So we're going to walk through a bit more of the process here, but aside from the voila part, am I accurately describing it, or is there something to add there?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, that's actually one of the most important distinctions between the approach that I prefer and the approach I prefer less, although even the less preferred approach can sometimes be important. So I'll kind of contrast two approaches. One of them is curve-fitting models to neurons. So imagine you have a neural network. The neural network has a lot of parameters. Ahead of time, you don't know what the right parameters are. So you can ask, how do I find the right parameters for this neural network? The obvious thing to do if you're interested in neurons is you get your neural data and then you make the target of the parameters matching the neural data, right? That's a very direct solution, mm-hmm. right? That's using AI techniques to model neural data directly. So instead of, say, solving ImageNet, I don't know if your listeners will know what ImageNet is. Do you know about ImageNet?
Go ahead and just give a really brief summary just to make sure.
Yeah. So ImageNet is this task which has millions of images and thousands of categories, and is one of the most important things that has happened over the past 10 years in stimulating research in AI, because previous to the advent of ImageNet, most of the data sets that people worked with were very small, and so nothing transferred, anything trained on one data set didn't transfer to anything else, it wasn't really necessary to have deep networks to solve them, and all sorts of properties of the data sets were preventing the advent of really knowing what were good architectures for solving vision problems. But mm-hmm. once ImageNet came along, suddenly it was like you really needed much deeper networks to solve it well. And moreover, things that solved it well were pretty good starting points for many other visual tasks. So even ones that were totally unrelated in any obvious way. And so it was really an important innovation to be using that type of data set, because it led to the development of not fully general, but pretty generalizable visual representations effectively.
Yeah, actually, I had Ryan Poplin on the show last week, and he used a fully trained network on ImageNet to then predict cardiac risk factors by looking at the fundus images of the fundus of the eye. So using deep networks. So yeah.
Right. Right. Although in that case, I don't know whether it was important that it be trained on ImageNet.
Right. Right.
But it is usually done. And for many, so that thing is a fairly low level thing probably. But things that require high level properties, it really does seem to be important to pre-train on ImageNet, or at least right now. This will probably be different in the future, but right now still, it's the case that if you're wanting to, say, solve some high-level visual problem like recognizing a type of bird or, a facial expression, you really want to start, if you can, with models that are trained on, neural networks that are trained on ImageNet, because it's actually a pretty good basis for many other visual tasks. And so the difference between, say, training and neural, so here's a strategy. okay, for getting a neural network's parameters, as I was saying, I'll go back to where we were before. So training a neural network's parameters to match neural data, you could just, instead of making ImageNet the target, you make the neural data the target, right? That makes sense, right? You want to solve, you know, a problem where you have a neural network that looks like the neural data. Well, all right, instead of doing gradient descent and backpropagation of the neural parameters, network parameters to solve some task like ImageNet, you do it to match the neural data. But let's call that approach curve fitting. It's like basically you match your parameters to the data. And the problem with this approach is twofold. One is that actually, with the amount of data that people do have or have had or had 5 years ago or whatever, if you do this, you end up dramatically overfitting because the number of parameters in a network that is complex enough to actually capture the data is too large for the amount of data that they have. So it's a sort of catch-22, right? You can't make a much smaller network because that's not complicated enough to capture visual patterns deep into the visual cortex. So you need something more powerful than that, more deep, basically. But on the other hand, given the amount of data that people have, if you do cause a deep network to match neural data on some training data, you don't have a lot of data and you end up overfitting. So if you like show it on new images or something or new neurons, or the system just like barfs. So it's really hard to do that approach. Okay. The other problem with it is that it's not well motivated. It's not because it, you know, suppose you end up doing your curve fit and it didn't overfit. It worked fine. Okay. It would be basically like saying, okay, yes, I can make this box look like that box, this black box look like that black box. In a certain sense, but it doesn't tell you why the neurons are the way they are, right? Right. It doesn't give you a sense of the reason why you see the patterns are because of some other deeper thing that they're doing. It just says these are the way they are. Now, that's not totally valueless. In other words, if you had a perfect match to the neurons in the brain, you could run many experiments cheaper than you could currently do them, right? So it's not totally valueless by any means to have a match. And if you could actually do it, maybe with the amount of data we could capture in the future, the curve-fitting approach would actually be a good idea. And so I'm not really against it if you're interested in making models of the brain. It's just that I'll contrast it with this other approach that actually has both been better from an accuracy point of view and more well-motivated. So The other approach is this goal-driven approach, where instead of trying to directly match the neural network to match the neurons' outputs, what you do instead is you say, okay, look, the downstream of the neurons, like the neurons are doing something and they're being used by other neurons downstream to like actually take some actions in the world or do some behavior. If you impose that behavior downstream, you can then ask, once you've gotten the system to be able to perform the behavior that the actual system can perform, does that impose a lot of constraints on the internal layers? And are those constraints that are imposed by solving the task enough to push the system to be a good model of the neurons? In some sense, we know that being able to do the behavior is a necessary condition because we know the neurons support the behavior in the real animal. The question is, how sufficient is it?
Right.
So if you impose the fact that it has to do a task downstream, like categorization, upstream in the middle of the network, how close to the neurons does it look? And it's far from a priori obvious that it'll look very close, because it might turn out that very downstream behavioral constraints are weak in terms of constructing what the actual neurons are doing, okay? Or we might not know enough about what the behavior are that really drove the evolution and development of the system. So we don't know a priori that doing certain behavior downstream is enough to cause the upstream or intermediate layers, the internal parts, to look like the actual neurons in those intermediate or internal brain processing areas. But as it turns out, if you make a fairly strong, challenging downstream task, one that's kind of more real world than toy-like, okay, it turns out that that's a strong enough constraint to give us in upstream layers the by far state-of-the-art models for basically every area of the visual system. In other words, the early areas of visual system people have worked on for many decades, then there's intermediate areas and later areas of the visual system which were quite a bit more mysterious. That is to say, there were many less well understood models, or the models of what could possibly be producing the responses in those intermediate neurons, what was driving them, were much more mysterious and less well understood. And as it turns out, the downstream goal driven constraint of like solving the task, if the task is strong, like a real world categorization task, turns out to put strong constraints on all these areas, so that actually, as a result, It turns out that the system, the model systems, the neural network systems, are the by every metric that I know of, substantially the best models of neurons in all of those areas, both the ones previously thought to be understood and the ones previously known to not be understood.
See, this was the voila part of my question. It's amazing. So let's back up. I mean, I was going to go to the visual system next because you've done this with multiple sensory cortical areas now, but you first focused on modeling that part of our visual system. So what part of the visual system are we talking about and what cognitive role does it serve?
Right. So first of all, I'll start with behaviors. Gordon Shepherd, a famous neuroscientist, once said, nothing in neuroscience makes sense except in light of behavior. And so I'll start with the behavior. And the behavior is the fact that humans or other animals, but especially primates, like monkeys and great apes and other higher primates, can, when faced with a complex visual scene, very quickly, within 100 milliseconds or so, or maybe a little longer than that, but not too much longer, totally understand what all the objects in their scene are and how they relate to each other. Right. I mean, for somebody who hasn't thought about that, it seems like an obvious thing. Of course,
right,
you just
right.
don't even think about it. It's so obvious, right? You can tell what's in front of you by looking, right? You can see, like, right now I'm looking at a bunch of computer monitors on my desk, and I can see them, and it's sort of obvious what they are, and I can recognize the cup on my desk and the lamp and the things that are next to it. But it turns out that, like, although it's very easy for human adults to do, it's an extraordinarily challenging computational problem. Right. For a very long time, it was something up until quite recently, it was utterly beyond the range of the best machine learning algorithms. And so this is an important.
I'll just interrupt you. It's like 2012 was a landmark paper, right?
That's right. Yeah. I think that you're thinking of the Krzyzewski, Sutskever, and Hinton paper on developing what's now called AlexNet, which is a neural network that had more than four layers and did better on the ImageNet dataset that I mentioned earlier.
So yeah, 6 years ago. There you go.
Right. And so up until that point, people were really having trouble training neural networks to solve quite challenging tasks. Actually, in particular, to train them, but the problem was that they usually overfit. But ImageNet was a hard task. It was so challenging that it was very, and it's so big, that actually it didn't lead to overfitting. It led to fairly substantial generalization. So, like, I think that landmark paper is landmark in the sense that it combined old ideas with computing power that was becoming available and data that was becoming available. Those were the two main things, the data and the computing power. And together, by executing the engineering of that well, they were able to show that you could train these deeper neural networks to solve the categorization task. And that's where, you know, things started to change a bit. And so the behavior that humans do, though, was then and by a lot, and is still now quite a bit beyond the power of the best computer vision systems in many ways, not in all ways, but in many ways, right? So the behavior is really where we start. Humans are able to do this amazing thing where they can recognize the objects in their environment, but it's more than just like recognizing cat, dog, computer monitor, whatever, right? It's like you have like this much deeper internal sense of where the objects are and how they relate. Like, for example, imagine you have like a, you know, I like this example. I noticed it once and it stuck with me. Is if you go to a wedding, you often get like a favor, and the party favor can sometimes be like a box of candy, and the box of candy is usually that transparent like plastic box, and there's like little candies inside of it, and then like a label on the top with some text like X married Y or something, right? So when you look at that, you instantly know all of the layers there. You know that there's a thing that can be peeled off the label in this very laborious but like micro way, and then you know that there's a transparent structure that you can see through but actually is rigid, and that you know how to count that the number inside of the particles of the candies is like bigger than 50 and probably less than 1,000, right? So you're like, you can look at this thing and you have this very strong internal visual model of the structure, right? And which is very rich in many ways. Now that's quite a bit beyond categorization, but it's likely to be the case that the same brain systems that were involved in categorization, like knowing is there a dog, is there a candy box, in my view, like the binary yes or no task of that, is probably also involved in those in estimating those other things. So that's the behavior. You understand the visual world around you by looking at a glance, or as my colleague Jim DiCarlo calls it, it's core object recognition. Okay, so that's the behavior. Okay, now the brain solved this problem somehow, and many decades of systems neuroscience, among other things, have revealed that there is a series of brain areas called the ventral visual stream. Okay, it's a stream because data comes in on the eyes and like outputs to the rest of the brain downstream after a bunch of series of like processing stages have occurred. And each of those processing stages is an anatomically distinct brain area that's kind of like a chain of operations, effectively. Okay, or is thought to be like a chain of operations. And those areas are named things like V1, visual area, well, ventral area 1, or V2, or V3, or V4. And there's other areas that are downstream of those that are a little more abstract that have names like inferior temporal cortex, and there's structure within those areas. So I don't want to there's a lot more detail than what I'm saying here. But it's basically that you have this series of brain areas encapsulating some kind of processing sequence where raw input from the world comes in, the pixels effectively on the retina, not quite, but like pixels in an image, and downstream, many stages of processing later, the outputs like represent abstract things like objects and relationships between objects and stuff like that, right? So somehow the box has taken kind of raw pixels data stream inputs and produced through like increasing stages of abstraction outputs that are like really able to structure the world in a behaviorally useful way.
So one might call it a hierarchy. So this is a good point to transition. What is a hierarchical convolutional neural network, and why is it a good tool to use in this case to study?
Right. Well, so there's two basic properties of this thing, of this structure, this brain structure that neuroscientists were able to figure out over many years of work. Okay. One property was, as you just said, is that it was hierarchical, meaning it was a sequence in some reasonable order. And the way that they were able to tell that was that if you look at electrical activity after the data hits the eye in these different areas, you see that there's a pretty reasonable progression. Like every 10 milliseconds, it goes from one area to the next area, right? So you can, each area is going from one area to the other, like about 10 milliseconds per area. And, 10 areas down the stream, you are 100 milliseconds in. And that's the areas where you can decode abstractions from, right? So there's this hierarchy of maybe increasing abstraction as you go from area to area, and you can see the electrical signals propagate from area to area to area, roughly on the order of about, as I say, 10 milliseconds per processing stage, right? So that's one observation, is hierarchy, that characterizes the system. There's a second observation. It's called, in neuroscience, it's called retinotopy. What it means is that basically the organization of the areas looks like different pieces of the visual field are mapped to different parts of the brain in a sort of map-like orderly way. So like, if you look at the world in front of you, there's like a 2D image, right? And there's like an upper left and an upper right and a middle and an upper left, lower left and a lower right, just like parts organized in a kind of 2D array. What's observed in neuroscience is actually their cells look like they're organized in a 2D array in each area.
Right.
Such that there is a kind of retinotopic, like based on the retina, that's where that original idea comes from, a retinotopic like or a retinally shaped map, a 2D shaped map of this, of the processing in each area. So each area is like a stage in the hierarchy, but within that stage there is a map, a physical map. So you can think of it as like a sequence of things that are mapped. So not just the retina, but the higher stages, the ones like that are processing more abstractly downstream after the retina, those are also retinotopically structured, though the retinotopy decreases at each stage. Okay, so it's kind of like it starts out really retinotopic, and then it gets sort of less and less retinotopic, less and less explicitly spatial as the calculations become more and more conceptually abstract. So you can think of it as a little bit like a system that goes from being wide and very explicit in the sort of locations of things, pixel locations, to a system that's deep, that has many different different types of calculations that it do, which are somewhat spatial, but also where the dimensions of those calculations are like varying along abstract dimensions, like, is it a face or not? Or, what direction is something pointing? Stuff like that, a little bit. Okay, that's a simplification, but you can think of these two basic properties as characterizing the visual system: hierarchy and retinotopy. And so a convolutional neural network is an idea that was developed in the late 1970s, that basically married those two ideas into a formal mathematical model. And so, like, the insight that was had in the late 1970s, and that was, I think, largely due initially to Kunihiko Fukushima, who was a researcher in Japan. Those sort of broad stroke insights from neuroscience were formalized mathematically into the ConvNet idea. But by themselves, those networks didn't do anything particularly well, and they didn't actually describe neurons very well.
Mm-hmm.
So the sort of hiatus in going from, like, the gap between 1978 and 2012 was not that, like, the basic broad strokes of the concepts weren't there, but that lots of details had to be filled in to, like, figure out effectively which specific ConvNets are good within that much broader stroke set of ideas, right? And so that's where I think a lot of the technical work was done. But conceptually, they had been around for a long time.
Good. So let's talk a little bit more about the specific networks that you used to model the ventral visual stream. So these deep networks, they can have as many layers as you want. And the earlier networks you're talking about had just a few layers. And do I have this right? You started with three-layer models, but then found that a four-layer convolutional neural network model worked the best, but now 12-layer models are the best?
Well,
is that right?
Yeah. So actually, we counted slightly differently in those days. So what used to be called three or four layer models would now be called, I think, effectively five and seven or four and six layer models. So there's a little bit of a nomenclature issue there. But that aside, yes, at the time, we could only do five or six layer models according to what today's counting methods. And so that's what we started with. Yes, certainly the five-layer models were better than the three-layer models. That was definitely true. But we didn't think there was anything special about the five-layer models. It was just that these were better because they were a bit more like the actual system, right? If you think about the visual system that I described a moment ago, it doesn't have three areas in the real brain. It's got more like 10 or 11 areas, or maybe a few more,
right?
Maybe even a few more than that, right? It's not totally clear exactly in all the fine-grained detail exactly how many areas there are, how many stages there are in this hierarchical sequence in the real visual system of the human or of the primate. So it's like we knew four wasn't going to be enough or five wasn't going to be enough, but it was awfully better than having two or three. And so what you find is actually that, like, if you make a somewhat bigger model, the matching sort of goes as you would expect. So in a five-layer model, the top hidden layer were the best predictions top hidden layer of the neural network, the artificial neural network, were the best predictions of the higher visual areas in the brain. The intermediate layers, like the third or the second or third layer, were the best predictions of the intermediate areas of the brain, the intermediate brain areas like V4. Okay, and the early layers were the best predictors of the early brain layers, like V1. So it's like the correspondence worked out in order, and moreover, the models were the best models at the time. They were quantitatively 100% better or more than the previous models. But none of us at the time thought that they were the correct final model or anything like it, because we knew that we were, like, off by a bunch of layers. So, you know, the right model is not 100 layers. It's probably more like 12 layers or so. You know, that's basically how many processing stages there probably are in the real brain. And the correspondence is now, like, the eighth or ninth layer roughly looks like the sort of 80%, let's say, of the way through the models look like what's called inferior cortex, which is a high area, a sort of downstream, fairly abstract area in visual processing. It's a few layers because there's a few stages within inferior temporal cortex. But, like, model layers, say, 8 through 10 match that best, whereas, like, model layers 6 or 7 best match intermediate area V4. And, you know, layer 3 is probably the best match for the brain area called V1, which is an early layer. So, you know, the correspondence has shifted in the way you would expect it to if you got a more fine-grained, correct model of the system. So it's not like there's a contradiction between then the four-layer model was the best and now the 12-layer model is the best. It's that, you know, the four-layer, or the five-layer model, I think you'd count it by now, was such that it had enough complexity to actually start differentiating the areas. But we knew at the time it was too shallow to be a fully correct model. Now we wouldn't want to use 100 layers, but something like 12 probably is closer to what the truth is.
Well, that's interesting. So that's like the big finding from the study is that the layers in the ventral stream map on really well to layers in the hierarchical convolutional neural network.
I would say they map on okay.
Modesty is great. It's interesting that even 12 layers is small relative to what's being used in modern deep learning architectures for computer vision applications. And I mean, what a mess it must be to understand what's going on in those 100 layer deep systems.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. It seems I'll contrast two flavors of what's going on right now. There are models like I don't know if you're aware of this thing called the NASNet. NAS is NAS. That's Neural Architecture Search. It's a procedure that was done by Google Brain in the last year. And that's actually probably the best ImageNet solver. It actually doesn't have hundreds of layers. It has more complicated individual layers, but there's something like 12 or 13 layers in that model. Okay. There's another flavor, which is like kind of the ResNet direction, RES, ResNet, where Res stands for residual. And those models can have hundreds of layers. And it's an interesting question how to reconcile them. One way to think about this is where you might imagine recurrent networks coming in. So ideally, you could think of the ResNet, the residual model, as basically being each like little stage of the hundreds of those stages not actually being separated in space, like different brain areas, but actually being separated in time. So basically like the rollout over time of a recurrent network that's previously been structured in a kind of convolutional way. So ideally what you'd find is that you would have a convolutional RNN that's has a reasonable number of layers, that has the same performance but better neural matching than a, say, 200-layer ResNet, right? That would be, I think, a reasonable way to imagine that conundrum is resolved. So something like a recurrent NASNet, is probably like bet as to what's the best model kind of in our current sights for the visual system. And that's where, you remember I mentioned this paper earlier with David Susilo? That's where that was the motivation and results there. So
yeah, please do. Yeah. Yeah. Send it my way. I'd like to take a look at it, and then maybe I can interview one of you. Just kidding.
Fair enough.
Well,
go ahead.
So I mentioned at the start, the way that you optimize these models is you tried out a few different models. Some you fit to the neural data, like we talked about, and others you randomly selected over the distribution of parameters to fit it. But one cool finding, like I mentioned at the beginning, is that the models good at performing the task were also good at predicting the neural activity in the different hierarchical layers of the visual stream. So how surprising was it, and what does it mean that the models optimized to match the neural responses didn't obtain optimal task performance, but the ones optimized to perform the task well then predicted the neural response as well?
Yeah, I think that is the most important result. And I don't know whether it's should be surprising or not. I think it was surprising at the time because I think a result of that strength had previously essentially not been obtained in biological sciences, like a modeling result of that strength, right?
Right, right.
And so the idea that you could understand the constraints well enough such that you could go off and do basically in silico evolution and development, which is a little bit like what you might imagine is happening when you optimize the network structures and then the parameters of within each network to solve a task. It's a little bit like running in silico evolution. The idea that you could go off and run that on like without looking at the neural data and then go take the best thing from that, the thing that won the evolutionary search, so to speak, go back, and then it turns out to be the thing that exactly is the best predictor of neural responses in the real brain area, that feels like a strong result because what it says is that there aren't that many solutions to the problem, and the brain and you, in your in silico version, kind of ended up in the same place. Of course, it's not exactly the same. Like, the match between the two is not perfect. It just happens to be the best match known for how to model those systems.
Mm-hmm.
So what would I say about that? Is it surprising? It's not surprising if you think that the constraints that the system was under were very strong. So if you thought ahead of time that there weren't going to be that many solutions to the task because the task is so hard that like almost nothing solves it, but only a few things do, then I don't know how surprised you would be. If on the other hand, you thought that it was a weak constraint, then you might be very surprised. So I think that the main result is that it turns out that things like high-level vision are an extremely strong constraint.
And do you think that this is a some sort of general law of computation underlying evolutionary progress?
No, I think it's probably true that here's two things you could say about it. For humans or higher primates, I think we have good intuitive access as to what the hard problems are for us in some way. And so, like, we're likely to be able to find problems that are pushing the limits of our system or that strongly constrain it in some way. And so for sensory systems in higher primates, I think it's likely that they are strongly constrained by their downstream functional behavioral goals. So for example, let's say it turned out that a very similar principle, you alluded to this earlier, works in audition. In work since division work, we've shown that actually by far the best models of the auditory system, the system that processes sound coming in from the ears, has arrived at in a fairly similar way. That is, you optimize to solve auditory tasks like speech recognition or music genre understanding, actually. And those things together constrain the system a lot so that you end up with a good prediction of what's going on in the auditory cortex parts of the brain, the parts of the brain that are a little bit like analogy to the visual system, but except for handling auditory data. So it works there quite well. We think there's good reason to think that it'll work in somatosensory, so in the touch system that you use by when you touch something to understand what you're touching. So I think that in sensory systems, in like organisms that need to do abstractions, it's likely that those abstractions force fairly strong constraints onto the neural system. So it's a good heuristic for coming up with models is to say, ask yourself, okay, what is the thing that we think this area does? Now let's solve it using neural network-like AI techniques. That if you didn't previously have a model, that's a good heuristic for how to come up with probably the best model, because it's based on what you think the system actually is doing. Is it a general law? No, I think there are probably parts of, well, certainly biology in general, and maybe neuroscience in specific that are not that strongly constrained. There's probably lots of things out there where they're like evolutionarily stumbled into a solution that's hard to get out of because like there's not a lot of other solutions genetically nearby. They're constrained by the structure of the genome, but it's not really constrained by the task itself. And so it's sort of such things would just be sort of just so. It got to this situation, you know, neuroscience-wise from the structure of the brain point of view, but it's not like there's a strong functional constraint underlying it. I would imagine there are such things. And so I don't think of goal-driven things as necessarily always being the right answer. It really depends on how strongly constrained the system is evolutionarily by its niche, which is variable, I think.
Well, it's beautiful work, and it's hard work. Actually, so you've been working with convolutional neural networks for a while now. Do you find yourself when some problem arises, or do you think, how could a CNN solve this thing? Do you see the world through that lens now?
Only if it looks like it's spatially structured. So, I think that if you have a strong sense that the problem is very uniformly structured in space, and the brain does it fast and well, if you know the human does it fast and well, and it's kind of got a natural spatial metaphor, which is true for some but not all problems, ConvNets are probably a good bet. But there are many problems like, say, generation of patterns in the motor system, like what David Cicillo was telling you about, which are not obviously so. And in that case, you might not start with a ConvNet. It really depends on the structure of the system. Like I would say in my research group, half of the people are working with ConvNets and half of them are not. It depends on the problem area.
Okay. I mean, so any part of the work that sticks out in your mind as being the most difficult or something that you had to fail at a ton before figuring it out?
It feels like everything feels like that.
Okay, that's good enough for me. Nothing that you really drove you to the bottle or anything.
I think that the biggest annoying challenge that we have, and where it would be great if there was some machine learning theory or advance that would help us avoid this, is the fact that the learning algorithms have a number of hyperparameters, meaning that when you do the training, you kind of set the rate at which the learning algorithm learns and then the rate at which it changes and how much it changes by when it gets to a certain performance level. And it feels like there's a lot of arbitrariness there that might have been evolutionarily solved if you're thinking about it from the brain point of view. But from the point of view of a modeler, it would be really nice if there was some way to know how to set those learning hyperparameters better ahead of time. And that's really, really annoying. And so it's like, if something is not working, it's probably because you've got, like, if you think approach A is better than B, you better have shown that, like, you've really tried to make both A and B work due to all the learning hyperparameters in both. And I think there's a lot of mistaken results out there where somebody didn't get the hyperparameters right for approach A, but got them right for B, and then everybody thinks B is better than A. And it's not their fault. It's just that it's a really challenging problem to actually investigate the dependence of performance on these learning hyperparameters, which is a real technical, that's a technical problem, which is feels like it makes the whole field to me feel a little bit problematic. but I don't have a better solution to it than doing a hyperparameter search over the hyperparameters and then really being sure that your result is robust to whatever is happening there.
Okay, I'm noting this down as something for me to go ahead and solve then.
Yeah, if you can do that, then I would be grateful.
okay, so in one of your papers, and we're not going to get into detail, but you list 8 open questions in computational modeling of higher sensory cortex. And I only want to note here, the paper starts off with the quote, "Any scientific development of long-term value opens up as many new questions as it answers." And I actually think the rule is that it opens more questions than it answers. Sorry, I should have said end quote there. So, but I know this is a beautiful part of science, but this is sort of a combinatorial explosion problem or a question explosion problem with no end in sight. Doesn't that suck in some way?
Well, I don't know that the correct rule is that it opens up more questions. I would say it like at least should open up some, because you know that there's a lot out there you don't know. And if the thing you just learned completely answers all the questions, then it was like you were kind of working on a small direction, right? If you know there's a big open space that you don't understand and the thing that you just did solves all the outstanding questions in some area, almost certainly it's because it was actually a pretty limited area. And there's some really beautiful examples of that, like beautiful examples of biology using some math where, you know, they were able to solve something very completely, but the thing was quite surface level. And so as a result, it didn't open up new questions, not because there were not new questions to open. There were plenty of them. It's just that direction wasn't going to find them. So, you know, like, I think that, like, we know, like, we just know. It's just true that we don't know everything. And in fact, the things we don't know are probably much bigger than the things we do know, right? So the best thing you can do is figure something out that sheds light on how to move through that space of unknowns. Right? Sucks or not, that's the truth. And I don't think there's any way around that for a very long time.
Well, it doesn't suck for grant funding, that's for sure.
Well, but when it's like, you know, let me put it this way. There are areas of math where, like, you can basically solve everything. And then what ends up happening is that people just move on to something else and they almost forget about those existing results.
Man, I really can't bait you here. Couldn't get you in a fight with David Cicillo. Can't get you to admit how sucky it is.
Well, I mean, it's true that we're like, you know, my wife and I have been watching Star Trek recently. And so it's like, you know, once you're Q, it's boring.
Right. All right. So, Dan, let's talk about children, infants specifically. So in your recent work, you asked the question, how can we improve AI using what we know about how infants learn? So what do we know about how infants learn that might be useful?
Well, here's one thing we know, which is that they do not have problems learning the concept of object permanence. Okay, so very early on, infants are very aware of the fact that if you have an object and it goes behind something, it's still going to be there, even if you like take the occluder away. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is to say, the object is a thing in the world that exists. Okay, and it kind of isn't going to just disappear because they can't see it anymore. Okay, infants know this very early. They don't need a lot of training to get that. And it turns out that that's actually a really challenging thing to train a standard convolutional neural network or a convolutional RNN even to do.
Okay.
And so that's an example of something we know from psychology. And in fact, I think there's a lot more of these examples now of things from psychology leading us in directions than maybe directly from neuroscience. But that's an example of a very clear piece of knowledge that comes out of the study of infants that is like should push us in a new direction in terms of thinking about what the structures in the brain are.
In the work I'm talking about, and I'll link to it in the show notes, you made an AI agent that learns to play. And so this is an agent that moves around in a video world, observing the video world and taking actions on objects. It also collects a history of the state that it's in at any given time and the actions that it's taken. And two components of this agent are what you call a self model and a world model, both of which are hierarchical convolutional neural networks. And these models interact in some way such that the agent learns to play. So just at a high level, do you want to describe the self model and the world models and how they interact?
So the key motivation here is another thing that children do, aside from knowing about object permanence. This other thing that they do is very obvious if you watch them, which is that they seem like they're self-motivated. Right. They do all sorts of stuff like young children, you know, 6 months, 8 months, whatever. When you're watching them, they do all sorts of things that are not because there's any obvious reward that they're being given. And yet they figure out how to structure their own behavior. And they do so in very characteristic and interesting ways. Like, for example, they look at objects, they bang the objects against each other, they structure the objects on top of each other, like they'll build towers and then they'll knock towers down. They'll play peekaboo, but the emergence of peekaboo, the emergence of tower building, the emergence of whacking objects together. So I like to call that whacking and stacking.
That's good.
Right. So those are behaviors that are very interesting. They seem to be spontaneously discovered, and they are such that if you really knew how to do them well, you'd have to have a pretty good model about the world. Right. So that's the behavioral, observation. Remember, we started earlier with a much less interesting behavioral observation, but still interesting at the time, was that humans can tell what objects they see around them. Here, the behavioral observation is the behavioral observation that infants do this kind of apparently self-motivated behavior that, you know, is really interesting and structured in a way that, like, no robot does, okay? So that was the motivation behind that work. And is a strong strand that I think will be really important in both understanding psychology of humans as well as really improved AI going forward in the future, is the ability to make models of self-motivated agents. And that is to say that the agent should be embedded in a really rich visual world. So it uses convnets from the previous work as like the potential visual encoder, the system that's doing the visual processing. But what's important on top of that is to have a sort of enough structure in the way that the system decides how to act interactively and enough of an understanding of what the goals of that should be from a sort of self-motivated point of view that you end up with a system that is not just processing the world, but is acting on it in a way that leads it to understand the world better. Right. That's the underlying goal there. And you mentioned these concepts of world model and self model, and those are particular technical innovations about how you might structure a neural network to do what I just said. But the ultimate goal, I mean, those maybe those are good and maybe they're not. They seem to be a good idea for now. But the ultimate goal there is basically you want a system that can engage in a kind of virtuous cycle. That is to say, it does something because it thinks it's interesting, and by virtue of doing that thing, learns how the world works. And by virtue of learning how the world works, can figure out an even more interesting thing to do, something that you couldn't even have imagined before you learned what you did. And then that allows it to take another step in the cycle of proposing a new fun thing to do, which pushes its boundary of its understanding further. And so it's kind of if that virtual cycle really engages stably, then you have a kind of a self-completing learning algorithm. And that, I think, is the most strong way to sort of imagine formalizing a takeaway from what we can learn from looking at infant behavior, is that they seem to really be great at that.
So in the paper, you describe the intrinsic motivation as the self-model antagonizing the world model, which is, I'm sure that vernacular comes from somewhere that I'm not familiar, but this is how the intrinsic motivation works.
Yeah, it's like if you think like it's formalizing the concept of something being interesting because it's something you don't already know how to predict. So it's if you have a prediction system, then the choice of action system is a little bit quote antagonistic to the prediction system because it's trying to figure out the things that the prediction system is bad at, and that's what should be interesting. Like if you already know how something works, it's not going to be interesting to keep doing it. So you want to figure out the thing that's sort of the opposite of what your prediction system is good at. And you can formally call that antagonizing if you want. But it's sort of like playing a kind of two-player internal game.
Okay, so you have this agent and it's moving around in the virtual world. And so you kind of had to grade whether this thing was learning to play, and it attained some developmental milestones, as you call them in the paper. What happened? What milestones?
Well, so the very first thing that the system did was understand what the consequences of its ego motion were. In other words, it learned to understand that if it moved its head, the world moved in certain, its visual input from the world changed in certain characteristic ways. So for a while, it had no idea what would happen if it changed, if it moved its head. But after a while, having done that, it learned what would happen when it moved its head. And then it got bored of that, meaning the system that was trying to antagonize the predictor realized that it knew, it already knew what the consequences of ego motion would be, and therefore it should actually take some other action. And so as a result of that, it found actually that it started to pay attention to objects. There are objects in the world, and ahead of time, the system had no idea. There's no built-in concept of objects. But it turns out that actually, by virtue of learning about the most easy thing you could do, which is the consequences of moving your own body, after that, after you've learned that, suddenly it turns out to be much more interesting to pay attention to objects, because understanding the way objects move when you whack them and stuff is much more challenging than just knowing what that the world will move in a certain way when you move your head to the right. And so that there's a clear stage where first it doesn't know anything about head motion and its own ego motion. It learns that. And then clearly, right, sort of in a sort of fairly sharp way after that, begins to start paying attention to objects. So it discovers a concept of object and object attention. Then after a while, it gets bored with that because it learns how individual objects work. And it starts to gather objects together, even if they're sort of far apart from each other in the room, put them together and start whacking them against each other. And that's actually much more interesting, much more interesting than any individual single object by itself. And so and then you can sort of all the while, as these stages of knowing nothing about objects, learning that interactions between objects are interesting, you can follow these stages. You can also ask, how well does it solve other visual problems? And as it turns out, as you see these stages occur, you get much better at also achieving visual recognition tasks and things that are like standard supervised tasks that you could sort of test the agent on every once in a while. And so you sort of see two phenomena there. One is the emergence of interesting behavior, kind of de novo. And the other is the fact that learning those behaviors, internally being motivated to learn those behaviors, leads to internal representations that are good for lots of visual tasks, even ones that the system, like downstream skills the system might want to have for other things.
This is amazing work, and I'm excited to see how it develops. I mean, what direction are you focused on now with it?
Well, we'd really love to get much more interesting behavior. Like, we can do a little bit of whacking now, but we don't have stacking. So we'd like to get stacking going. We'd really love to see that it handles novel objects in a good way. And I think the most interesting direction is to introduce other agents. So other agents should be a lot more interesting in some ways than just static objects. And understanding how a system, like, why it pays attention to other agents, what it thinks about those other agents, and how it balances between interest in objects and interest in agents, other people, other like curious agents in the world. That's really the major direction that we need to go in. But, you know, and that sort of connects like visual processing on the one hand to sort of social interaction on the other.
Are you familiar? I know you said this is not a video game, so there isn't extrinsic rewards. Are you familiar with the OpenAI 5 team? Do you have any idea how your networks compare to those networks?
Well, I don't know. That's a very strongly extrinsically motivated solution. So I think that's
right.
It's like, actually, before that video, I mean, when that was first there was like this sort of the guy who was beaten, the champion who was beaten. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. So he actually mentioned briefly in the little video as to how he had previously occasionally been beaten before by the AI in the that came with the game. So that game actually, there are computer solutions that have solved that problem. Yeah. And, you know, those are things that computers can be programmed to do reasonably well, actually. But they're very specific, intrinsically motivated things. And I think that the big difference here is that we really want to figure out how to approach that without having to build in the specific extrinsic motivation. And it might be that, like, we don't yet know how to do that well enough so that the resulting thing can learn a game as well as a human can. I think we're far from that. So it's still better if you want to solve a particular extrinsic problem to go directly solve it. But I think in the long run, the goal would be to try to be as good as humans are.
Okay, so I'm going to, I know we're pressed for time here, so I'm going to wrap up with just a few more general questions. So where do you see your work here, this most recent work we're talking about, on the spectrum of weak versus strong AI or general AI? And how general is the plan for you?
I don't know. I don't usually think about strong or weak AI, or like generally, I don't know exactly what it's supposed to be like. I'm not even sure humans do that. I mean, take behaviors that are interesting that humans do and figure out how they work. And so whether it's general or not, we'll find out, I guess, would be the answer. Once we know how humans do it, we can ask ourselves, well, is it general or is it a hodgepodge of sort of somewhat semi-general but somewhat specific solutions? I just don't know, and I don't want to speculate.
Do you think that AI needs neuroscience to make it work?
No, I think it needs psychology.
And do you think we're at the beginning of a big advancement here, or do you in AI and understanding the brains, or are we maybe asymptoting?
I don't know. That's basically like asking what the land property values in Menlo Park and Palo Alto are going to be over the next 5 or 10 years. Literally,
I realize that these are very speculative questions.
Those are actually highly correlated questions.
Right.
I don't know. From the point of view of somebody who wants to buy a house soon, I really hope it's asymptoting. But from the point of view of the science researcher, I hope it's a full steam ahead. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it's good enough. I have two more really quick ones. What advice would you give to someone wanting to study neuroscience and AI specifically? Which would you start with?
AI.
Okay.
Learn how to train neural networks and learn the underlying math behind that.
Ooh, that's different than anyone else has said. So anything you wish you knew before getting into neuroscience and or AI?
I wish I realized that earlier. I originally thought that the right thing was to apply math to like molecular biology, and I got spanked by reality in that case. So, you know, I got into it later than I would have liked. But aside from that, I sort of ended up in the right place at the right time. You know, in the sense that I don't know that I had special insight that this was going to be the right field, but suddenly it took off around the time that I was getting into it, and that was really lucky. I'm not sure there's any insight there other than the fact that you should be in the right place at the right time if you can be.
Well, we're getting spanked by the ticking of a clock, so I'll let you go, but I really appreciate your time, Dan.
All right, thanks a lot. This was a fun conversation.
I told you it was a little fast, a bit of a roller coaster, but I know it was worth it. To get in touch, hit me up on Twitter at pgmid, PGMID, or send an email to paul@braininspired.co. See you next time.